Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Catherine Belton, author of Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Interference in American elections, the sponsorship of extremist politics in Europe, war in the Ukraine. In recent years, Vladimir Putin's Russia has waged a concerted campaign to expand its influence and undermine Western institutions. But how and why did all of this come about, and who has orchestrated it? In Putin's People, Catherine Belton reveals the untold story of how Vladimir Putin and the small group of KGB men surrounding him rose to power and looted their country. Putin's People, called by the Financial Times the single best volume written about Putin, the people around him, and perhaps even about contemporary Russia itself in the past three decades, is the definitive account of how hopes for the new Russia went astray, with stark consequences for its inhabitants and increasingly the world. Catherine Belton is an investigative correspondent for Reuters. She worked from 2007 to 2013 as the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times and previously reported for the Moscow Times and Business Week. In 2009, she was shortlisted for Business Journalist of the Year at the British Press Awards, and she joins us today from London. Catherine Belton, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me on.
What role does Putin's early years as a KGB agent in Dresden, East Germany, play in shaping him and the regime he leads today?
That's a very good question, and it really goes to the heart of the matter of how he operates. He did spend his formative years from 85 to 1990 in Dresden, in this outpost in East Germany. Everyone has always seen Dresden as a backwater that Putin and his own allies in the KGB have made a great play out of, also kind of beefing up this angle that the fact of his career in Dresden meant that essentially he was washed out. It was, you know, it was a backwater. He didn't have anything to do there apart from write senseless reports and take tourist trips. He himself said that he was so bored, he drank so much beer, he put on a couple of pounds. But really, they seem to have been engaged in quite an elaborate cover-up. And indeed, when they left Dresden and headed back to the Soviet Union following the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 89, they made great effort to make sure that all documentation covering their activities was destroyed. They were sort of, Putin himself said, we burned so many documents, the furnace nearly exploded. And then the station chief in Dresden has also described how they moved 12 truckloads of documents back to Moscow. So they, it seems they really didn't want people to know what they were up to. And it seems sort of on closer examination, with good reason, because not only was I told by one former senior KGB operative that Dresden was a very serious center for the transfer of embargoed technology from the West into the Soviet bloc. We know this from the interviews that I've had, and also from a defector who used to work with Putin in the Stasi. He defected to the West shortly after Putin departed, and he's also told about how Putin sort of worked very actively with one Stasi officer in particular, who operated under the guise of a business consultancy to recruit scientists and businessmen and essentially entrap them into working for the East and sending over technology. Now, Dresden was a hub for this because it had a major computer plant, which it already successfully cloned the IBM. The Western embargo was ostensibly against any dual use technology or goods that could be used for military means being transferred into the former Soviet bloc. But this kind of essentially encompassed a wide array of kind of computer technology too. And Russia and Soviet Union, as you know, was in a race with the US over the Star Wars technology. So this became more and more imperative, particularly in the years that Putin was there. So he was using kind of an array of front companies and a web of intermediaries to transfer this technology technology. We know this too from that his allies were engaged in this from the German Parliament's own investigations. And they also found that some of the men around Putin then in the Stasi agents that later very clearly emerged to be working with Putin later on when he did take the presidency were essentially involved as well in numerous actually fake deals, including one to build a hard disk factory that was going to be the most expensive ever built in East Germany, which never materialized. It was never built. And in fact, what they did was siphon out all the cash. This is tens of millions of Deutschmarks into front companies in Liechtenstein, Singapore, and other places. Essentially, what they were doing, they were trying to move money because they could see the writing was on the wall for the communist regime. They knew the regime was going to collapse and that they didn't have much time, but they wanted to preserve their networks. They wanted to preserve Stasi networks, KGB networks. So they were trying to move money and hide it through front companies in these offshore jurisdictions so that they could essentially keep operating even after a communist fall, not just in East Germany, but also in the Soviet Union. They had some foresight. And it sounds a bit familiar to how Putin's men operate today. They've also become embedded deep in Western markets, where we see through kind of revelations like the Panama Papers that they're still using a wide range of offshore companies to conduct their operations. So that's one element. But then the other, even more interesting element was this was also at a time when Soviet Union, like Russia today, couldn't compete directly economically or militarily with the West. So it resorted to covert actions. It resorted to active measures to try and undermine the West and kind of sow chaos and disruption in Western institutions. And among these measures were support for extremist organizations. This same defector has told of how Putin was a handler for a notorious neo-Nazi who first moved to the West and then returned back to Dresden, where he helped stoke the rise of the far right after the Berlin Wall's fall. And then also in my own conversations with actually a former member of the Red Army faction, which was a far left terror group that was very active in West Germany at the time. It led a campaign of bombings which targeted US Army bases and also West German industrial titans. And basically wreaked havoc across West Germany. It's been documented there was a German investigation into their activities following the fall of the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. And it's been clearly shown that the Stasi were closely involved in supporting them. But what hadn't been known before was that apparently, according to this former Red Army faction member, that Dresden really was an important meeting place for members of the Red Army faction. This former member told me about how he would travel first into East Berlin on the train and then take a car to Dresden, where he'd meet in a safe house with members of the KGB and with the Stasi. And apparently among them was Vladimir Putin, who was, he said, essentially taking the lead. Now, they weren't giving them orders, but they were certainly giving suggestions on potential targets and helping them acquire weapons and cash through their agents in the West. Now, this former Red Army faction member, he had a very compelling and credible story, especially when backed up by reports by former CIA analysts that essentially the Stasi was doing the KGB's bidding in support for terrorist groups, including the Red Army faction in West Germany. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't possible to verify with other Red Army faction members because, unfortunately, they're all either in jail or dead, or perhaps that's not unfortunate, depending on your viewpoint. But I did ask a former Stasi officer who worked with Putin then about this claim. And essentially, when I asked him, his face darkened noticeably, and he just said, look, when it was top secret. The KGB tried not to involve us. I didn't know anything about this. And whenever something like this happened, they always tried to blame us. They tried to blame the East Germans, you know, and so I didn't get a straight answer at all. And one of Putin's own close allies from the KGB also reacted very sharply when I asked him. He said, no one has ever confirmed that the KGB sponsored terrorist groups, and you should never try to.
Catherine, if I can ask you, how do these Western governments and businesses end up complicit in these laundering schemes of Russian businesses finding ways to transfer hundreds of millions of dollars into accounts abroad? I think you do indicate in your book that this is, of course, Russia's instigation, but at the same time, there is complicity on the part of the West. How does that work?
Yeah, I think so. I think mostly it's from the beginning, it was a kind of naivety. I think the West believed that there was nothing really for Russia to do now apart from join a Western-led global order. They believed that sort of after the end of the communist regime, after the fall of the Soviet Union, then that's essentially the course that Russia had embarked upon. And to all appearances, you know, they were perhaps right in believing that, at least kind of a sort of on a surface level, because that's certainly what its political leaders declared. But beneath the surface, there were this group of kind of former security service men who were very active. They were still a force to be reckoned with. And with Putin, they were able to come back to power in 2000. And for a long time, Putin, too, was paying lip service to the idea that Russia wanted to be integrated with the West, that it wanted to be integrated into global markets. And really, he kind of tried to entice Western investors to Russia. But I guess the fatal flaw in this came for Western investors is when Putin and his security men, as early as 2003, began essentially subverting the country's court system in order to take over oil companies and other sort of major industrial giants from their independent owners, just to make sure that the independent owner, in one very well-known instance, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was Russia's richest man, he owned a company, an oil company called Yukos, which was Russia's biggest. Putin's men believed that he posed a political challenge to them. And it seems they cooked up some retroactive tax charges against him, threw him in jail, and then began to carve up his oil company. But they did so in a way that was kind of like death by a thousand cuts. It was piecemeal because they wanted to keep the Western investors on side. And really, the West kind of bought into this because Putin could identify this really crucial chink in the Western system, that essentially it turned out that these Western investors, they didn't really care about democratic niceties like the rule of law and so on. They could see full well what was happening to Khodorkovsky and how his oil company was essentially being picked apart in a politically motivated case, but they didn't care. They just wanted to be part of it. They wanted a piece of the action. These Western energy majors were lining up to take part in the process. And that's the moment, I think, when Putin and his men realized that the West could be very easily corrupted. And indeed, the Kremlin state oil champion, which took over Khodorkovsky's oil company in this way, soon after it did so, it was once worth $6 billion. And all of a sudden, a few years later, it was coming to market with a value of $80 billion because it acquired some assets for a few billion dollars. You know, you do the math, suddenly it was worth much more, and it hadn't had to make any effort to acquire these assets. But the West still opened its arms to the Kremlin state oil champion Rosneft. It allowed it to list on the London Stock Exchange. Then investors rushed to take part. And essentially, Rosneft, this is an arm of the Kremlin, and it was becoming deeply embedded in Western markets. And it's the same too for the once independent tycoons of the Yeltsin years of the 90s. They became sort of more and more beholden to Putin's security men, because once the Putin security men had essentially bent their court system to impose their will once, they could do it again and again and again. And all these independent businessmen realized that essentially they only own their business by staying on the good graces of Putin and the Kremlin and the security men. So they became essentially loyal trustees of Putin's Kremlin. They already had companies listed in the West, or they were in the process of doing so. And essentially, again, the West welcomed them. They believed that in joining Western markets, these Russian tycoons would have to become transparent, follow Western rules, and so on. But essentially, the opposite was happening, because the Western markets weren't actually demanding enough transparency from them. And what the Western markets were gaining was essentially a flood of cash that was essentially under control of the Kremlin, but nobody really questioned about whether the independent tycoons might be asked to carry out strategic tasks for the Kremlin. Sort of issues over transparency of financial accounts were kind of brushed over, and nobody really cared. They just wanted access to all the finance that was flooding out of Russia, particularly into London and in some instances into the US. And in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis, a lot of Western institutions were really desperate for capital.
You're listening to a conversation about the book Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West, by Catherine Belton. How extensive are Russia's holdings in London, and how is that felt in London's politics and economy, especially when it comes to what you say in your book is flooding Russian cash aimed at British businessmen that may even affect Brexit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm afraid it's one that Western law enforcement is still getting to grips with, because unfortunately, once this money has headed through London, it becomes more and more difficult to trace. And the Russians became sort of expert in setting up numerous money laundering schemes, and some of which have been since uncovered. There was an infamous one called the Moldovan scheme, in which $14 billion was laundered through London in the space of 4 years. Then there's the mirror trade scheme, in which Deutsche Bank played a very important role. That was another $10 billion in illicit Russian cash. And most of this money was going through incredibly opaque companies in London, these entities called limited liability partnerships, which don't have to disclose who is the beneficial ownership, who's the beneficial owner. They don't even have to produce accounts which are true, because they don't have to conduct any business activity in the UK, so they're never taxed. So they essentially could just make everything up. And so you have tens of billions of dollars flooding into London, and it's all untraceable. You can't tell where it's coming from. And some of that will be going into maybe hedge funds. Hedge funds in the UK became major supporters of Brexit. Hedge funds are also notoriously intransparent. They don't have to declare who their clients are, whose money it is that they're managing. And really, they were the biggest supporters of Brexit in the UK. And nobody's even tried to look into that. And then there was another individual named Aaron Banks, who is an insurance salesman. He's always very strongly denied any support from Russian or that his money was ever linked to any Russian activity. But he gave the biggest political loan in UK history to the Leave campaign. He gave £8 million, which I guess in US terms doesn't sound like much, but for UK politics, it's a lot. And I think the Electoral Commission here wanted to conduct an investigation into where that £8 million came from. And the National Crime Agency essentially took up the mantle and investigated. And they cleared him of any wrongdoing just by saying, well, he got a loan from an Isle of Man company that was part of his business. And that's where the £8 million pounds came from. But to say that is also, again, it kind of demonstrates the lack of power of our own law enforcement agencies, because the Isle of Man entity, you know, it's co-owned by another Arron Banks business partner who happens to have been deeply invested in Russia. Documents show, despite his own denials, he was deeply invested in Russia right up till the end of 2016, and they were being offered deals by the Kremlin to take part on sweetheart terms in a privatization of a Russian state diamond company and so on. So it's kind of layer upon layer on layer, you know, which makes it very difficult for our underfunded law enforcement agencies to get to the bottom of it. And what's really kind of a case in point, when they reach a dead end just at an Isle of Man company and say, that's it, our powers will take us no further. But again, I must add, Mr. Banks, who's very litigious, has always denied any wrongdoing.
So let's talk about Atlantic City and move across the pond, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Could you help us understand how the Russians, going way back to the 90s, I guess, found their way to the Trump empire and bailed them out, I suppose you could say. And I guess the question I have is, what was in it for Trump and what was in it for the Russians?
Yes, it does. This was a relationship that does, in fact, go back to the early 90s. I came across one Moscow businessman, Shalva Chigirinsky, who met Trump as early as November 1990. He was introduced to him by some Atlantic City casino operators who'd made a beeline for Chigirinsky because he was one of the first Moscow money men moving money out of the Soviet Union ahead of the communist fall. He also happened to be very good friends with some very senior KGB foreign intelligence operatives, and they'd encouraged him to move abroad and to set up businesses there. And, you know, it's kind of just a lot of funny connections. And this guy, Chigirinsky, after he met Trump, he sort of continued to orbit him sort of almost ever since then. He was kind of part of the network of Moscow money men who had connections with Russian intelligence, who worked with Trump ever since then. And this activity really did step up following the September the 11th terrorist attack in the US, after which the US banking system introduced new regulations which made it much harder to move illicit cash through the US banking system. And then it became very much the case that that the Russians and this particular network of money men began moving more money through high-end real estate in the US, that this was the vehicle of choice through which to move Russian black cash. And it certainly seemed that the Trump Organization was among those vehicles, that they were parking funds through him in the West. And he was convenient for them, because as in the words of one former Trump Organization executive, Donald doesn't do due diligence. So he wasn't really asking questions about where the money was coming from. And we've seen his partnership, for instance, with the Bayrock Group, which worked with him to build three Trump towers in the United States, one in Phoenix, Arizona, another in Florida, and another in Manhattan, Soho, and where they were essentially giving Trump as yet undisclosed management fees and license fees just for the honor of using his name on their towers. So, you know, to some degree, that was a convenient arrangement for them because his profile gave them status. It also helped them get access to US bank money, probably. But it was also, you know, extremely convenient in that Donald didn't ask any questions about where their money was coming from. And a former finance director has alleged in one lawsuit against the Bayrock partners that essentially it was a mob-run organization. And we've heard from Felix Sater's own admissions that he had high-level ties with Russian intelligence. And we know that he was part of this same network of mob-linked Moscow money men. So for a long time, the Trump Organization was a very convenient vehicle Donald Trump, too, was a known entity to these guys. He'd been visiting Moscow since 1987. But I think at some point, yes, he did also become a political opportunity. I'm sure at the beginning, perhaps in their wildest dreams, they couldn't even imagine he could become US president. But he did. And we know from the assessment of the US's own intelligence community that Putin's Kremlin essentially did all it could to assist Trump in his victory in 2016, though we don't know sort of how great an impact their assistance had.
How has that Russian black cash been used to fund political parties on the far left or the far right around the globe? Again, we understand what's happened here in America, but that's not the only place it's happening. Eastern Europe, especially, I believe you mentioned Hungary was one country that benefited, its autocrat benefited from this Russian cash flowing into the country.
Yes, Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, has always been very pro-Russian. I've delved into this a little bit in the book. He was very close also with some Russian organized crime groups who believed that they had compromising information on him. He, of course, denies this, but it seems that somewhere along the way, the Russians have a hold over him. So that's as far as he's concerned. But there are also other kind of operatives. There's also in the Czech Republic, for instance, there's been sort of an envoy from a major Kremlin-linked oil company who's maintained an office in the castle in Prague, or who's very close to the Czech president. We don't know to what extent he's carrying out orders from the Kremlin, but I mean, it sounds like he's played a great role in cultivating him. But the problem is we're still only sort of getting to grips with the cash flows and being able to trace them, because, you know, a lot of it does take place through very murky front companies. So there's still a lot that we don't know and a lot that hasn't been visible. In the Panama Papers, it was possible to trace some funds going from Kremlin kind of operated funds to a right-wing Polish operator who is kind of very, very pro-Russian and always espousing a closer relationship with Russia. We've seen emerging in taped conversations between Liga Nord, which is the far-right populist party in Italy, that they were angling to gain access to sweetheart oil deals with Kremlin-linked companies, that they were going to acquire oil through front companies at a knockdown price and then sell it on to the world market at the higher world prices and keep the profits to fund Liga Nord's activities in Italy. And in return for this, the Liga Nord operative caught on tape was sort of pronouncing that we want a much closer alliance, indeed across Europe, with the Kremlin, that they wanted an end to this, what they call the neoliberal world order and sort of a populist alliance that would be very close with the Kremlin. So we've seen bits of these schemes kind of coming to the fore, but there's still an awful lot that we don't know.
You're listening to Catherine Belton. She's the author of Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took On the West. One of the things we know for sure is that Putin has a way of suppressing independent voices in Russia. And just recently, a regional governor in Russia's Far East was arrested for murder, and his constituents took to the streets to protest the arrest and to call for Putin to resign. And I think there were substantial numbers of people in those crowds. Is there anything to such a development like that when it comes to Putin's ability to hold on to his job, so to speak? Or is this just another day in the life of Vladimir Putin, where this will go away once his government gets a hold of this guy.
Yeah, I think it kind of remains to be seen. They have had to deal with sporadic protests in the past, and they do tend to go away. But essentially, he's kind of in an uncharted territory himself. He might have just won a nationwide vote, which essentially allowed him to remain as president right up till 2036. And he seemed to win that vote with a resounding majority of 78%. But there are claims of widespread, in fact, unprecedented vote fraud. And indeed, the Kremlin was rushing to get this vote pushed through as early as possible, because it's really clear that the pandemic is hitting the Russian economy hard. And there are also much lower oil prices than Putin is used to. And Russia is really dependent on oil and gas for most of its budget revenues. And, he's also kind of essentially coming to terms with the effects of his own policy, which has led to huge underinvestment in the Russian economy itself, because when he and his security men have been able to essentially acquire whichever businesses they like, it's not a very good climate to attract investment. And most businessmen haven't been investing funds for fear of becoming a target for the Kremlin and that their businesses could be taken away from them. So even without low oil prices, even without the pandemic, the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, recently spoke out about a lost decade for Russia. There's only been 1% economic growth over the last 10 years, because essentially all Putin's men have been doing has been acquiring assets for themselves, dividing it up between themselves and using the cash flow to shore up their own power and also cause as much chaos as they can abroad and disrupting other democracies. And it's not really a viable long-term strategy, because they haven't been able to develop their own economy. And we're going to see this kind of come home to roost now in the next year or so, because obviously from the pandemic, there are going to be bankruptcies in Russia. Putin's government hasn't been giving bailouts to small and medium businesses. You know, they're only 25% of the Russian economy, but it's still quite a major chunk. And Putin's security men have been sitting on a rainy day fund of oil wealth, $165 billion, which is meant to bail out companies essentially in times of crisis. But it's only going to be enough to bail out the biggest and most strategic companies. And a lot of other factories and plants are already at a standstill. People aren't getting their wages. There was another instance I saw recently in the far north where Gazprom, the big strategic Russian state gas giant, hasn't paid its workers apparently for months. And I saw on Twitter recently footage of these state gas giants workers essentially going on a rampage through the state gas giant's offices because they hadn't been paid. They just decided to start tearing up the office because it's the only outlet they had. So, I think, yeah, Putin has got a lot of difficulties ahead, but, unfortunately, his security men have a pretty tight hold on power. They can quash and jail any opposition figure they like. But yeah, we've yet to see if these protests in the Far East will spread or if it's just a one-off.
You mentioned Putin's election and the election irregularities in his recent re-election. Where can the people of Russia go to get objective reporting of any kind to know what's really going on in their government? I assume that has to come from the outside very indirectly. Can't imagine anybody can stand up as a journalist in Russia today and tell the real story without, as you just said, getting thrown in jail.
Well, unfortunately, that's more and more the case, because there used to be, when I was there, I left in 2014, and even for some years after then, there used to be some kind of semblance of independent newspaper reporting. There was a very well-known business daily called Vedomosti. It wasn't allowed to delve into high-level corruption, but it could, for instance, report that there had been vote fraud or that the polls didn't look too good for Putin right now. If you looked at the independent ones and not the state ones, you know, this was there, and there is still a radio station which sometimes will allow itself criticism, but this is becoming less and less. And indeed, in the run-up to the nationwide vote on allowing Putin to stay president till 2036, all the journalists at the Business Daily, which is one of the few remaining independent outlets, were very effectively censored. A new editor-in-chief was put in place who began removing all articles about Putin's falling popularity ratings, and, you know, anything critical of the state oil giant Rosneft was also removed. And essentially all the journalists were, you know, they weren't fired, but they, because they had some pride still in their work, they walked out. They couldn't work under such conditions. So it's really a great shame, because we're seeing more and more this kind of clampdown. In Putin's government, there are still some progressive voices, some people known as the technocrats, but the longer Putin stays in power, the less weight they have, and his security men really run the show and do everything that they can to stay in power. So there are some internet outlets. There's a very well-known anti-corruption blogger called Alexei Navalny, who is also an opposition leader, and he's done a great deal to dig up corruption schemes in the highest levels of Putin's administration. And he does a great job of bringing them to millions just through the internet, on YouTube and so on. But he's now being investigated for criminal libel, and that could be just another ruse to silence him and maybe even put him in jail. So things are pretty bleak out there right now.
There's a New York Times report that came out recently about the bounties that Russia may have paid the Taliban to kill American soldiers. And there's an expert in your town of London on Russian security services. He's with the Royal United Services Institute in London. He says that, I think his name is Mark Galliotti. He says it would be incredibly stupid of Russians to massively escalate what is already testy relations with Moscow. I guess I have two questions on this one. Is this where Russia could have used a slush fund of some kind separate from its own governmental revenues, so there's no fingerprint, so to speak? And then secondly, what do you think? Do you think that this was something that likely happened or not?
Yeah, you can be sure that they haven't left any fingerprints. And indeed, that's the issue that the US intelligence community faces in its assessment. It seemed they were transferring cash through murky networks used by the Muslim community, known as Hawala networks. Funds were being, the US intelligence community has managed to confirm that there were sort of substantial transfers coming from a unit of Russian military intelligence into a Taliban linked criminal network. They've been able to trace that cash, but to be able to precisely say that these funds were earmarked for killing US troops, I mean, that unfortunately that's based only on human intelligence. This is what various Taliban who've been captured by the US have been claiming, and so it's not 100% verified. So yes, it's part of a slush fund, so it's very difficult indeed to trace, but it has been traced back to the Russian military intelligence unit. But, you know, as what I'm afraid it's part of a pattern of behavior that we've seen this behavior in Soviet times. We've seen it during Putin's stint in Dresden, when the KGB and the Stasi were essentially organizing and sponsoring terrorist attacks in the West against the main enemy. US Army bases were being targeted, for instance, by the Red Army faction. It was a campaign of disruption, and that's what the Soviet Union resorted to when it couldn't compete directly, economically, or militarily. And I'm afraid that's what Putin's security men are up to here. And it also stems back to a long litany of grievances. You hear the TV anchors on Russian state TV talk about this too. They talk about how the CIA was funneling cash and weapons to the Mujahideen during the Soviet-Afghan war in the 80s, that this lost the lives of thousands of Soviet troops. And one of them, while denying that Russians had ever paid bounties, while denying that, he said, well, if this activity did take place, then it would have only cost the lives of 22 US troops. So, you know, it's kind of almost like an odd denial by now. They're sort of almost saying that the US has it coming to it, you know. It is this, it's a pattern of behavior where you see Russia wanting to interfere and make life difficult for the US, which unfortunately is still hardwired into the minds of Putin and his security men as the main adversary. Part of that is a Cold War legacy, and another part of that is the way it believes the US has ignored Russian interests since the end of the Cold mm-hmm. War, that is this viewed Russia as weak and sort of not important, and whereas sort of Russia is trying to stand up for its own, what it claims are its strategic sphere of interests, and indeed it views Afghanistan as part of its own backyard too. So I'm afraid the potential for this to be true, you know, is probably more than 50%, but I'm not sure whether Putin would have directly authorized such payments himself, but the appetite for such meddling certainly exists.
So I have time for one more question, and this may be a tough one to answer on the spur of the moment, but if you could give one piece of advice to the West, let's not say Great Britain or the United States or wherever, just the West, on how to decontaminate Russia's politics, Putin and his people, from Western governments and politics. Is there anything that comes to mind that you would say to either London or Washington, wherever, yeah. Berlin?
Yes, of course. I'm afraid that in this instance, it really must be that the Western governments and the Western leaders must turn their attentions at our own systems, because I think the Russians have this view that to some degree that the West has become arrogant, lazy and complacent. And I'm afraid to some degree that they're right, that there has been this sort of rush for profits that has overridden sort of concerns about democratic niceties and the rule of law, that our politicians have become sort of weak and easily corruptible. And you see this in our UK Parliament, unfortunately, that you see that sort of our politicians have come under fire for scandals in which they've bent the rules or broken the rules for kind of trying to declare sort of apartments and acquisitions of even garden furniture as legitimate expenses for parliamentarians. And really, this just goes to show how cheap they are and how cheap it is for Russians to buy influence in our country and probably in the US too. You know, for a Russian oligarch, it's chump change to spend $3 million building a kindergarten in Minnesota, for instance. But after he does so, he can have a local leader if not in his pocket, he will certainly have influence with that person. And then they've been able to do this on quite a large scale. And it's also a question, like, for instance, in the US last year, the House passed a very important bill to make sure that kind of these extremely non-transparent entities known as LLCs in Delaware, which have been sort of the vehicles for huge floods of Russian cash into the US economy, but also into super PACs, into the political system, there was a law passed that would require them to disclose beneficial ownership. But unfortunately, that seems to have since been stuck at the Senate. So really, it's essential really to clean up our own system so that we can't be so weak and corrupted anymore.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the book is Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West by Catherine Belton. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Great. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.